Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Today is the day.
Good morning. Today is the day. Okay, so thank you to those of you who are responding in all manners and forms this morning. Thank you to Jay Marsh in Simsbury, Connecticut, who wants me to know Simsbury, Connecticut has the most bears. And then the total email is this: Simsbury has a lot of bears. There you go. I might need a little more than that. I might need a little more than just your declaration that Simsbury has a lot of bears. So, Jay Marsh, get out there, get me a story, get me a picture, get me some sort of bear encounter. All right, Ann Hill, thank you for letting us know that in terms of where in the Word you are today, Ann has just finished Genesis and is starting on Exodus. So you guys can communicate with me via text at 877-933-2484. You can always email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. Let me know where in the Word you are today. Joining us again, Nicole Phillips. You can find her at nicolejphillips.com. And she has returned with another kindness story. Welcome back, Nicole.
Hi, Carmen. I tend to sit in the Word in Galatians. I have been for like the past 8 years. Is that a problem that I just sit with the fruits of the Spirit?
No, it's good. As long as, you know, as long as what you're doing there, I think, is like a continual fruit inspection and you're seeking to cultivate, right, an ever more abundant harvest of righteousness in, you know, cooperating with the Holy Spirit. Like, I don't think that's a bad place to sit and simmer.
Well, and cooperating with the Holy Spirit is exactly what today's kindness story is about, because it's vacation time. A woman named Sarah went down to Florida, and she was on the beach with her girls, and they met what they ended up calling Shark Tooth Grandpa. And it was a man, and he had a little bucket, and he was going along the beach, and he was collecting these shark teeth. And the girls were fascinated by this, so he showed them, you know, exactly how to do it, And so it was a cute encounter. Well, Sarah was on her way back from Starbucks a couple days later with three very large caramel lattes. And one was for her, one was for her sister, and one was for her mother. And she ran into Shark Tooth Grandpa. And the Holy Spirit said to her, give him one of the coffees. Now, Sarah said, well, wait a minute, Holy Spirit, I'd like one of those coffees for myself. And so she ended up following just this prompting in her heart, handed over the coffee. The man was delighted. He was just delighted. You know, and Sarah went back to their condo and hotel room and realized, you know, there's plenty. There's always plenty to share when the Holy Spirit's involved. So, Carmen, I love that. I thought, you know what? That's the reason why I sit in Galatians, because, man, the fruit of the Spirit keeps coming alive.
Oh, amen. All right. And now, as a person who grew up in Tampa, let me just go ahead and let everybody listening know, if you want to go to Florida and you want to actually find shark teeth on the beach, you need to go just south of the Venice jetty. So you need to go to Venice, Florida. You need to go just south of the Venice jetty. There's a place called Casey Key. And there's also a place called Manasota Key. Those are the best place to collect shark teeth on the beach in Florida. That's because, you know, I feel like there should be, I feel like there should be a travel log in addition, since this is a vacation story. Hey, Nicole, thank you so much. Friends, you can find Nicole online at NicoleJPhillips.com. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of years without Christ.
Hey, welcome back. Joining me now, Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Dr. Stevens, welcome.
Welcome. I just wonder if there's a dental office for sharks near those keys. I wonder why there were so many teeth on the beach.
Okay, so I think sharks are different than us, and they must, like, their teeth must grow back. I don't know. I haven't actually done this research.
Do.
Oh, see,
yeah,
there you
do.
Go. Well,
yeah, they're always in rows and they just keep coming out all the time. So I was just making a joke.
Really? Okay.
Really,
see, we
trying anyway.
Really? So rows of teeth are good in sharks, not good in people. That might be the dental news of the day. Share with us fetal tissue research. As soon as we read the word fetal in any headline, those of us who are pro-life find ourselves, you know, immediately concerned. So talk with us about what is going on here in the fetal research arena and the new restrictions on it.
Yeah. Well, there's been research going on in fetal tissue for years, and some of us remember, and I'm sure you do, when this was in the big news, Planned Parenthood was harvesting organs, brains, livers, spleens from newborn babies that had been aborted. In fact, they would actually even change the method of abortion so they could get better tissue. And this was a money-making thing. Even though they said it was just handling fees, you pay for about abortion $800 to $1,500 for an abortion. Well, you get $1,000 for a fetal brain. You can get so much money for any organ, and they could harvest and make a lot of money. So that really caused them to change their practices. But still, the government was paying for fetal tissue research. And just last week, or a couple weeks ago, they came out under the new administration and said they're stopping that. They're not going to incentivize harvesting organs from aborted babies. And that's good news for all of us because there was still a lot of money going out. Plus, they're going to fund research to find alternatives of how they can do research without using fetal tissue at all. So a lot of good news for us, of those that are cared about babies, because when you get organs from aborted babies, that incentivizes abortions. It changed the way they do abortions. And it makes women that are going through that process feel, well, you know, there's some good coming out of it, which can incentivize them to have the abortions and again and again.
Okay, when we think about the research that is being done, medical research that's being done in this using fetal tissue, I think the immediate, you know, question mark in people's minds is going to be not only how is it procured, but how would this new restriction then limit or slow down the research that's currently underway? So can you speak to that?
Sure, absolutely. Well, there are over 500,000 spontaneous miscarriages every year. So there's plenty of place to get fetal tissue from, no different than doing an organ transplant from somebody in a car accident. A miscarriage is a tragedy, but there is a source for fetal tissue with permission from the parents to say, can we have some of the tissue to do research that could be life-saving for someone? So with that source of tissue, we still can do fetal tissue research without getting it from electively aborted babies.
Okay, so let's you and I take a brief break, and when we come back, let's talk about sleep. You and I can't take a little nap during this time. We don't have enough time to take a little nap. But when we come back, let's talk about the importance of sleep, and let's also talk about insomnia. So I am talking with Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. We're talking about all kinds of medical news today, and the next topic we're going to talk about is sleep. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. We'll be right back. Continuing my conversation with Dr. David Stevens from the Christian Medical and Dental Association, you can find them online at cmda.org. One of the things that you will find on their resources page are all kinds of position statements and really wonderful explanatory documents on the primary concerns that each and every one of us has as Christians in the culture as we begin to talk about medical concerns and medical issues. And so it's a great resource for you. Go check it out, cmda.org. I particularly like the little public policy section, but they've got all kinds of resources available on their website. So Dr. Stevens, let's turn our attention here to sleep. Let's just start with this. Why does sleep even matter? Like, why do I need sleep? Wouldn't I be much more productive if I just didn't sleep or if I could figure out how to avoid it?
You're like me. You want to get a lot done. I can hear that, Carmen. You know, I think if I just could get another couple hours without sleep, I could get a lot more done today when you have so much to do. But sleep is so necessary. God designed us for it. And without it, you have car accidents. You fall asleep at the wheel. You tend to get depressed. You tend to get more anxious. You tend to eat more. The list just goes on and on of how important sleep is in our lives. And, you know, in sleep, what we call sleep hygiene. In other words, planning for good sleep, being in a dark room, no electronic lights on, especially screens from phones and things like that, actually stimulate the brain and make it difficult for you to go to sleep. Getting in bed at a regular time, getting up at a regular time, having the room dark with the curtains closed. You know, quiet. I sleep with earplugs. I travel a lot, so I'm in noisy areas. I put in a couple foam earplugs when I go to sleep just routinely because I sleep better when that goes on. And then still some people, Carmen, have insomnia. In fact, I woke up last night at 3 a.m. going, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be asleep. And there's some new information that's helping us to understand that better as well.
Okay, so now we've established that I should sleep. Talk with us. Talk with us about it. I think that one of the things that prevents a lot of us from being able to sleep is that our mind is continuing to process the day that we have just lived. And sometimes that means processing regrets, processing things where we were misunderstood or we misspoke or we actually did something that we know was wrong. We hurt someone. And then there's also the sort of worry about the day which is now ahead of us, or the worries of life. Talk with us a little bit about dealing with all of that as a Christian in order that we can actually sleep.
Yeah, and I think there's a number of things. One is, a lot of people like to get up in the morning, have their devotions. I like to have them at night, and that kind of helps put the day to bed. And then a time of prayer, and that gets my mind ready for sleep. But then there's some little practical things you can do. There's a new study that just came out recently from Baylor University down in Texas where they looked at making a to-do list. And what they found out, just a simple thing, that instead of doing a to-do list in the morning when you get up, do it at night before you go to bed. Now, that almost seems counterintuitive. You think, well, man, you'll be worrying about all you need to get to do tomorrow, but have to do tomorrow. But what it really does is help you have a plan to say, okay, I've got it organized for tomorrow. And people that did that just took 5 minutes and took out, you know, their phone or piece of paper or whatever and wrote down my to-do list for tomorrow, got to sleep faster and slept better through the night. It was kind of like they had put their worry to bed about all they had to get done tomorrow. So there's little techniques like that. You know, the world says do meditation before, you know, purposeful meditation before you go to sleep. It's much better to spend time with Christ, to be in prayer, to commit to Him the issues of the day and give to Him to tomorrow. And then you'll sleep a lot better, which makes a huge difference in how you're going to approach the day that's coming.
So one question that I could ask you as an ethicist, as a person mm-hmm. who is surveying the medical ethical issues of the day, would be, is there an issue that keeps you up at night in terms of medical ethics today?
The issue that's most concerning to me and to our members is right of conscience, healthcare right of conscience. And that means the ability to practice medicine according to your deeply held religious beliefs, moral beliefs, ethical standards. And this is under tremendous attack in our country. You're even seeing it in the major medical journals, articles saying there is no such thing as right of conscience. If it's legal, you have an obligation to do it. If you're not willing to do it, you shouldn't be in medicine or you shouldn't be in your specialty. And we're seeing more and more attacks on Christian healthcare professionals losing their jobs, not getting promotions, not getting a job, students not getting admitted to medical school. And there's a new right of conscience regulation that's come out that's now being contested in the courts to actually put some teeth into the laws that already exist. But this is what our members are concerned about. 95% of Christian healthcare professionals in a survey we did said they would leave medicine before they violated their conscience. So this is a big issue for your listeners, because if some people have their way, there won't be any Christian healthcare professionals in this country unless they bow their knee to doing abortions and, assisted suicide and other things that they may have moral obligations not to do, or biblical concerns about, transgender transitions, all these issues. I have one of my members who is a faculty member at a major medical school, chair of his department, psychiatrist, that lost his job because he testified in the bathroom case in North Carolina on transgender transition. And he got so much pressure put on the school, they fired him after, 20 years as chair of the department. So this is of a great concern, not so much about losing your job, but losing Christians in healthcare. And it also points out the reason, Carmen, why people need a healthcare professional in this day and time who shares their biblical beliefs, because it's becoming more and more important as more and more ethical issues arise in healthcare and in vitro fertilization, all sorts of things. The list just goes on, where it's important to have a Christian healthcare professional. And people can go to our website, put in their zip code and say, I'm looking for an OBGYN or a family practice doc. And actually, you can find a healthcare professional. Not all our members are there, because most of them have their practices so full they can't take new patients. But if you need one, that's one place to go to find, as well as to your church and ask people who they're going to that are Christians in your area. But that's becoming more and more important, and we're trying to defend healthcare professionals of faith continuing in healthcare.
So if you go to cmda.org/right of conscience, you can actually see a very long series of articles that are available on this particular topic. And I asked that question, Dr. Stevens, not knowing that was going to be your answer. But I have these really dear friends who they now live in Pennsylvania, but they lived in Atlanta for a really long time. It's where they raised their kids. And their son, John, is now at Wake Forest. He absolutely feels a passionate calling to become a doctor. So, when he finishes college, he intends to go to medical school. Talk to John right now and give him a hopeful word of encouragement that this passion that God has placed within his heart, this calling, is for such a time as this, as a Christian who also wants to serve in the medical profession.
Yeah, John, the way you get in medical school is you go to the library when everybody else goes to the ball game. That's how you get into medical school, not because you're the smartest, because you're the most disciplined and you stick with it. Secondly, keep your goal firmly in mind, what you want to do. It's a long road. It's a long road, but it's worth it, because you have the opportunity to minister to people at their greatest point of need. In fact, I tell our members the best mission field left in this country is in healthcare professionals' practices, because who else sees 4,000 or 5,000 people a year in need and have the opportunity to show compassion and care and raise faith flags and tell faith stories and share the gospel as people express an interest? And that's what Christ did. There's actually more recorded of him in the four gospels healing than there is of him preaching. He met people at their point of need. As you go into medical school, trust it to the Lord. Work hard, do your best, and then as you apply to schools, put that in God's hands. Talk to medical students that are already involved there as Christians, and there's a Christian Medical and Dental Association group there at Wake Forest at the medical school. Go start going to their meetings, make some friends, get advice from them, and see what's in your future, and then be persistent. If you don't get accepted initially to medical school, go get a master's in public health, or go get another degree and then apply again. Persistence really counts, and more medical students are older than they've ever been. And then trust the whole process to the Lord. He's in charge. If he's called you, he's going to make a way.
So we had a young man here on the program recently who wrote a book called Addiction Nation. His name is Timothy King. And one of the stories that he tells about how he became addicted to opioids after a surgery that left him with some really debilitating pain. And it was his doctor who, in a extended conversation with him, eventually said, Tim, let's talk about this ever increasing amount of medication you're requesting. Let's talk about your level of pain. Let's talk about addiction. I think that what you are testifying to in terms of the mission field that doctors have available to them today that many of the rest of us do not have, is that doctors are with people in absolutely their most vulnerable moments of life and when they are making ethical decisions apart from their faith community. And so, I just can't I just can't give any greater encouragement to people who are listening who feel called to medicine to absolutely pursue it. And we want to thank you, Dr. Stevens, and the Christian Medical and Dental Association for being a place that not only provides us with great information and wonderful public policy advocacy on these fronts, but also a network that Christians who are engaged in medicine and in the dental arena have an opportunity to engage with one another in fellowship and really get a lot of personal encouragement and support. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Carmen. It's great to be with you.
We look forward to talking with you again. All right, friends, let's take a minute for Breakpoint. So up with me next is Peter Kapsner. He and I are going to talk about what we have come to call 50 Shades of Truth. Let me ask you, when the same-sex marriage conversation erupted in this country prior to its approval by the Supreme Court or nationalization by the Supreme Court through the Obergefell decision in 2015, what were some of the arguments that pro-biblical marriage advocates were making? Can you even remember? Can you remember the things that we were told would never happen? Can you remember being accused of hyperbole, as if we were warning against things that would never happen? Well, it's pretty much all happening. We're going to talk about that next with Peter Kapsner.
What if the last thing you said to your son today were the last words you ever spoke to him? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. It's a sobering thought, isn't it? No one wants to be remembered for nagging remarks or a judgmental spirit. I realize that not everything you tell your kids will be positive, but you can still compliment your child every day. Tell your son he's not an intrusion on your life. Tell your daughter that conversations with her are the best part of your day. Or try this powerful phrase. My friend Chelsea tells her children, even on your messiest day, my life wouldn't be as good without you. Affirmations like this speak right to your teen's heart, and the loving words from mom and dad are what we hope they'll remember long after we're gone.
Looking for more parenting wisdom? Go online to parentingtodaysteens.org or search for Parenting Today's Teens in your favorite app store.
Joining me again today, Dr. Peter Kapsner, in our 50 Shades of Truth series, our ongoing conversation at the intersection of culture and identity and faith. Peter, welcome back.
Thanks. Good morning, Carmen. How are you doing?
I'm well. So my first question is, since you have just returned from Paris.
Yes.
And you visited the famed Notre Dame. Give us an update on what you experienced in terms of the restoration and repairs that are now underway.
Yeah, it was pretty stunning to walk by. I think I underestimated just sort of how breathtaking, again, that cathedral is. It is so large and just the scale is so enormous, which would then indicate how enormous that fire really had to have been to take down the spire and so many different parts of the cathedral. But the reconstruction is well underway. I know that there is some angst in some quarters in France about what the shape of that reconstruction is going to look like. Will it have a more modern kind of vibe? Will they go ahead and restore it back to how it looked prior to the fire? And you know, there's different angles and different ideas about that. Because when you read about these historic places, just about anywhere in the world, they almost always have. And in 1700, you know, it got destroyed by the warfare or a fire or something, and then it was restored and changed. And so it'll be interesting to see if 2019 goes down in sort of this history of Notre Dame in which the cathedral itself actually changed shape or whether they just restore it back to what it was. And I think the most exciting part was seeing out front, there is all of these barricades and fences and barbed wires and then just like tents that you would see at a wedding or something that looked to be housing quite a bit of what should be on the inside of Notre Dame. And there's armed guards everywhere. So you weren't going to jump that fence to get some of this stuff, but it was fascinating to just see it all laid out.
Okay. So now turning our attention to the ongoing conversation here in the United States about what I will characterize as not only the redefinition of words, because we're going to have that conversation, the redefinition of marriage, the redefinition of family, but maybe of greatest concern to me, where that has all led, which is the commodification of children. I remember back in, let's say, 2008, 2010, 2012, 2014, I remember conservative voices laying out a litany of concerns related to the redefinition, the proposed redefinition of marriage here in the United States. I remember conservatives laying out a litany of concerns that once we go down this road, there are some things that will happen. They will be along this path, and it will be a devolution of our culture, and it will include the necessary redefinition of family and fertility and what it means to have a family and to raise a family. It will redefine family, and it will ultimately result in the commodification of children. We were told at the time that will never happen. You guys are hysterical. You don't know what you're talking about. You are trying. This is fear mongering. You're trying to keep people from marrying who they love. Talk with us about where we have arrived in our culture less than a decade later. Actually, you know, it was only 2015 that the Obergefell decision was handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. So fast forward 4 years. Where are we in terms of the commodification of children, the redefinition of fertility, and the way that all of us are being forced to participate in something that we find unconscionable?
Yeah, boy, there's a lot of topics in that one, Carmen. And I appreciate that you mentioned it was just 4 or 5 short years ago. I remember in some of the classes in which I was teaching, just talking about the tsunami has already come. And it's swept over and it's knocked all of the historic family and sexuality foundations to rubble. And the question is now, on what foundation are we going to build? And to your point, the church back then was trying to rebuild a foundation and say, hey, look, if we don't stay true to biblical values of marriage, we're going to end up in some really rough spots. But certainly the activistic LGBTQ community won the day, just even linguistically. You use terms like fear-mongering. The church was being accused of being bigoted and exclusive and bullying and archaic and sort of backwards, unenlightened in its thinking. And then, of course, all of the language being used around the activism was open and affirming and inclusive and embracing and tolerant and enlightened and socially evolving and we're smarter now, all of that. And that all sounded so good. And just the linguistics of the day won that battle. But here we see some 4 years down the road. Now, one of the troubling realities that you and I and Paul have been talking about a little bit off air is even ideas of couples getting married in gender fluid kinds of relationships that are non-standard heterosexual male-female relationships. Now they're wanting to have children and they obviously can't because it requires a male and a female. And so there's a change in terms of even how medical insurance companies should cover infertility treatments, which historically the definition is if you've tried to conceive for a year, unprotected sexual union between male and female, you can now apply for medical coverage of in vitro fertilization treatments. And that's a physiological definition that's showing that something is not right either within the male or the female from a physiological standpoint. And so they could apply for medical treatment. But now, and to your point, commodification of children, everybody wants to have a child. So many people want to have a child. Those that want to have them in a non-heterosexual relationship have to rely on some kind of medical intervention. And so the move right now is to try to get the insurance companies to change definitions of infertility from a physiological reason, whether the womb is just not able to hold children or something wrong with the sperm count, some kind of reason like that, to social choices. And there should be social reasons for infertility treatment, meaning that two women have married each other, or two men have married each other, or somewhere on the gender fluidity continuum, they've made their social choices. And because they can't have kids, they should still be covered by insurance treatments to have children anyway, whether it's, you know, through different techniques. So it's fascinating to see that redefinition of what's happening in non-standard family units.
Non-standard family units. I mean, you and I, we work very diligently to talk about these concerns and issues in a way that dignifies the humanity of everyone involved.
And of course.
We have, and it's important, and that's essential. I want to, when we come back from the break, I want to try to have a conversation. And I'm sure that as listeners are listening today, they're like, Carmen sounds kind of agitated about this subject matter. I am very troubled that we have, as a culture, lost all sense of what I'll describe as time and place. And so when I read this series of headlines, and I'll just throw these out there, and then, Peter, we can talk about them when we come back. When I read that drag queen story time is not just being held in public libraries, but now in churches during worship, when I read that that actors and actresses are live streaming their dramatic reading of the Mueller report from the Riverside Church in Manhattan, when I read that pride flags are festooning sanctuaries of churches across the country this past Sunday, I am concerned that as a nation, we have absolutely lost all sense of the appropriateness of time and place, like where things belong. So can we have that conversation when we come back?
Love it. Yeah, absolutely, Carmen.
All right, that's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. So I wish, Peter, that I was mindful enough to remember the quote from Alice in Wonderland about things being up being down and down being up and all of that. I really feel like Lewis Carroll saw this reality coming that we are living in today, which is very much inside out and upside down. And there's a church in Cincinnati that hosted drag queen story time, not just, you know, in the public library, or not just, which I have issues with as well, but not just in the church, but during worship. And I understand the desire of some to celebrate this Gay Pride Month. I do not understand the compulsion of Christians to festoon their sanctuaries with pride flags and festoonery. I don't know that that's a word, but you know what I'm talking about. The bunting.
I do.
The rainbow bunting. Yeah. So yeah. Help me regain a sense of time and place and speak into appropriateness.
Yeah, boy, you know, I don't know what your response was in 2015, 16, 17, when all of this really began to break loose in our country. But I think the common Christian response was really wanting to do the loving thing. And you referenced in our first segment the idea that there was this sense in which you didn't want to bully back, and you really didn't want to shout too loud and come up against and all of that. There was sort of this, there was an openness, at least to the personhood of the individuals involved. And I think that was the key thing driving it. But I think what may have been underestimated by, for sure, me, and I think many of the pastors and the churches in which I find myself running, and even the university life, was how intentional and how aggressive the activism would continue to be to try to make headway in the culture itself to normalize all different forms of sexuality. And so in this desire to want to affirm the humanity of people involved, there, I think, was a bit of an acquiescence where there was not a message in response to a very forthright and very aggressive message of inclusion. And the church really didn't have a message in response. And as you and I know, Carmen, children are so impressionable, and families are so impressionable, and people are so impressionable, that if you don't have some sort of countervailing message that says, hang on a minute, this is the wonder and beauty of sexuality, and it does not mean that we are going to become bullies or bigots or anything along those lines, but here's a message of hope. Here's the picture to which we're called. Here's an understanding of why maybe we're moving as a culture. We just didn't see much of that. And it's, so it's leading to increasing events like you just described in the headlines. And I'm not sure how much energy and time and effort we should spend as the church to try to now rechange the culture. I think you can make some gradual progress, but I think it's going to turn into a really ugly cultural war if we do something like that. But I think the invitation does remain to the church to really start creating a robust and expansive message about, so here's why male and female relationships are called to, as in this covenant sexual union of marriage, and here's what a family can look like, and here's what it means to raise our kids, and here's healthy and holy sexuality. I think that's where the most sort of return on investment will be, is if we engage that direction to have a different kind of message within the walls of the church, because I just don't see that there's going to be any major cultural change until things finally sort of implode on some level. And then the church needs to be there to help pick up the pieces. But to try to fight it all right now, I think is a losing battle. But we can really spend a lot of time and effort wondering about, so what does it mean to be in a healthy sexual relationship?
Okay, so I do think that when we talk about the impressionable, the reality that young minds are impressionable.
Right.
You and I would say there has been really in recent history, really an onslaught of effort, and it continues, of those who would be advocating for non-binary, non-conforming, queer, LGBTQ, however you want to characterize it, an absolute acceptance that this is normal, to normalize all of this. And so right. when I read in the USA Today a headline that says the young are regarded as the most tolerant generation, that's why results of this LGBTQ survey are alarming. The lead sentence, young people are growing less tolerant of LGBTQ individuals, a jarring turn for a generation traditionally considered embracing and open, a survey released Monday shows. So we have, this is the annual Accelerating Acceptance Report. And just by the name of it, they anticipate that every year, year over year, acceptance is going to accelerate. Like, that's what they are pressing themselves toward. And so it was alarming to them to find out that that trend is reversing. I think that's because people are waking up to reality and saying, yep. okay, it's one thing for me to acknowledge that you are free to make choices about yourself and your identity and your engagement in the world. It's another thing for you to say, I have to, I must bow down to all of that. And I think that's the wake up call potentially for LGBTQ advocacy groups, is that, you know what, we reach a point where we say, okay, it's one thing for us to be tolerant of you. It's another thing for you to be cramming this down our throats in such a way that we have to reject it.
Yeah, and I think you nailed it on so many levels where we are right now. And especially, it was interesting in the light of the study, the explanation for the rising intolerance among many in the millennial generation for the LGBT community was because of maybe some policies that the Trump administration put into place that banned transgenderism in the military. And they said that youth are very impressionable. And so when they see this ban, they're going to react accordingly. And I thought, Carmen, I don't know how many of my youth even know about the ban in the military, but what they do know is a very active curriculum within educational systems that is that teaches children how to be open and affirming and embracing. I know they're exposed at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old to different forms of sexuality and on non-binary kinds of forms, and they're invited to wonder about what they might be. I would suggest that's where the impressionable minds are being most impacted. So then how do you explain this reverse in which there's a rising intolerance? And I think that's what you hit on, is I know I've got young children in my family and teenagers in my family, and Paul Perreault was making a great point off air with me about it too, and it's consistent with my kids, is that they are seeing that the changes that young people are going through, sometimes biologically with hormone treatment, or they begin to identify as a different gender, or they're entering into same-sex relationships, that it isn't actually resolving anything for them, that their sense of depression, their sense of anxiety, their sense of turmoil is not resolved in going through this process. In fact, it's getting worse. And so some of the rise of the intolerance versus this very active agenda is because we're starting to see the fruit of the decisions where things are not getting better. They're actually getting worse. And in fact, I've referenced it before in the program, but the sex reassignment surgeon in Russia, who's one of the world's experts on this, he stopped doing it. He said, because we're wreaking havoc on our kids. It's abusive and it's not changing anything.
It's an interesting time to be alive. It's a challenging time to be a Christian. And yet we absolutely must be speaking the truth. We must do so in love. We must recognize the times in which we live, and we must absolutely be gospel advancing people in the midst of all of it. Peter Kapsner, thank you for helping us sort through some of these headlines today. And thank you, as always, for just simply continuing to engage with us in this 50 Shades of Truth conversation.
Love hanging with you, Carmen. It's great.
Yeah, it's mutual. All right, friends, we'll be right back. Okay, apparently the most bears are in Simsbury, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.